Welcome to Jewish Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you all kinds of interesting guests, telling you truths rarely heard in the corporate mainstream. Well, today we're going to cover a few topics, including the topic of my most recent book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11. We're going to talk with Julian Vigo. She's a scholar, filmmaker, artist, permaculturist, DJ, yogi, and human rights consultant. She's written all kinds of very interesting scholarly work and has done interesting creative work as well. The permaculturalist part gets me interested because I like to try to practice permaculture myself. So let's get going here. Welcome, Julian Vigo. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. So, you know, when this Charlie Hebdo thing happened, my first response was, this is terrible. You know, I'm Muslim. I've been Muslim since 93, and I'm also a satirist, and I often offend people with my satire, and a lot of them don't get it. So my first response was kind of, oh no, you know, some Muslims who didn't get it probably went and shot up some satirists that they shouldn't have, and it made me feel really bad. And that was for about 5 minutes, because then I looked into it and discovered that something very strange was going on in France. Tell me a little bit about your take on this event.
Well, I mean, what's going on in France isn't really any different than what's going on anywhere else in the West, unfortunately. since even the first Gulf War, there's been a growing climate of anti-Muslim sentiment, both politically, certainly in the media, and that has been consciously translated to popular culture, of course. Now, this, I mean, you know, many scholars talk about how this, you know, came at the same time as the fall of communism, et cetera, et cetera. But what's really remarkable about this is how we have sort of unconsciously accepted this kind of Islamophobia. People I know in New York after 9/11, good friends, made incredibly offensive comments after 9/11. I think trying to be at the same time in solidarity with the quote-unquote victims of 9/11. And there were victims of 9/11. The problem is that the way media posited the victims of 9/11 is they were all our BFFs. It became this very nationalized, larger community. You know, the West is always criticizing the Muslim notion of ummah, but I mean, we've mirrored that. And we've mirrored the martyr with our heroes. And everyone became a hero by dying. Everyone became a hero by sympathizing with a hero, in a sense. So there was this quasi-nationalistic, pseudo-religious war already ongoing from the moment the Twin Towers fell. And the onslaught from there, militarily, which was devastating to the people in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, began this undercurrent within American and Western European culture, Canadian as well, of us against them. And as much as people of the left or the pseudo-left, a lot of neoliberals in the States would make fun of George Bush's famous, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, it's amazing how many of Bush's critics took on that moniker. They became very much, as leftists, anti-Muslim and unconsciously taking on that, you know, you're with us. And so this has gone on. I mean, you know, the history of France, obviously, with Muslim immigrants is quite different than the United States. But the anti-Muslim sentiment, nonetheless, is driven in on both sides of the Atlantic. You can see this in the United Kingdom.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, yes. I agree completely. That's one of the reasons that the subtitle of the book is The French 9/11, because there are those parallels. And you mentioned the sort of the mirror image, in a way, of certain kinds of sacred Islamic tropes with this new sort of sacred that came out of 9/11, the martyrs and the heroes and the anti-Muslim ummah, as it were, the anti-ummah. And you know, I wonder to what extent you thought about whether this was actually constructed. That is, that the West has lost a sense of the sacred, and a lot of folks, including neoconservatives, argue that it's impossible for a culture to exist without a sense of the sacred. And the neoconservatives, of course, are Nietzscheans who have misread Plato. and they believe that it's their role to cast the shadows on the cave wall to bamboozle the masses. And that they also believe that every nation or political entity needs to have a state religion. So it looks to me like 9/11 was very carefully scripted to produce this precise kind of pseudo sacred that it gave us. Have you considered that?
Well, certainly. I mean, I'm working on a book now that deals with martyrdom in part. It deals with martyrdom both from the side of the West, the way that the victims of 9/11 were martyrized, in quotes, and then the way that the Western media portrays all the Islamic fighters, or any fighter who is necessarily Islamic. Might be Muslim, might not be Muslim. They have dark skin and a beard, hey. And it becomes this whole process of, well, they're martyrs. I mean, just the other day, someone on Facebook I know posted in response to the Boston, murder, the murder, that this will just, the pronouncement of the death penalty will just increase claims of this person being a martyr. And I, of course, objected to that because this is a very much Western mediatized perception, and it's an Orientalist perception of the Muslim that Edward Said has long traced back in his seminal work of the late 1970s. We know that Orientalism has existed. We know that it continues. The problem is, like so many issues in the West, we don't seem to stop our bad patterns. Our bad political choices, how many times have we been here before? So the sacred of 9/11 was very much using the catalyst of these deaths of these people, these very, tragically, it's a horrible thing what happened on 9/11, that goes without saying. But when one analyzes 9/11, one is immediately put in the position, just like I just did, of saying it was a horrible tragedy, so that someone doesn't say, "Are you excusing terrorism?" by analyzing the larger scope. So immediately, the whole scene of this is anti-intellectualized. You cannot discuss it. And if you can't discuss what happened, how can you politically address what actually happened? I mean, people have forgotten since 2001 about blowback, right? But we're seeing it again with ISIS. ISIS is an indirect form of that as well, in terms of the sponsorship that went on economically to fight the Taliban and so forth, and what money went where and who grew out of that, right?
It's still going
And
there.
the
Now,
whole.
U.S. planes are airdropping weapons and supplies to ISIS, as I'm sure you know.
Yes. Well, this is the it's almost comic, I mean, I think Mel Brooks should make a film about this because you've got this.
Hello, Julian. Looks like we may have lost the feed. Okay, so we're going to have to try and reconnect because Julian is over. Up and try her again. Oh, here we go. Phone is ringing automatically.
Hello?
Hello, Julian. I'm sorry. I think we
Oh, I'm
lost the connection.
screwed up. No problem. I'll sort of begin again so we
Well,
can.
now that's okay. I kept talking and we made it a quick break. But yeah,
Okay.
you were talking about how people are can't really even think about what happened on 9/11 because of this sacred aura around it. And one of the things that really has struck me is, as I'm sure you know, in subaltern studies, the whole the key trope is let the subaltern speak, hear the suppressed voice. And I am just really struck at the way that the virtually unanimous Muslim interpretation of 9/11 and the war on terror has been completely suppressed in not just the Western media, but also in academia. When it happened, I was in Madison, Wisconsin. I was teaching at the university, and I was, hanging out in the Muslim community. Every single Muslim in Madison, Wisconsin that I knew, lots and lots and lots of them, all said instantly, "This is an obvious false flag, inside job. Obviously, bin Laden couldn't, or his guys couldn't possibly do anything remotely like this themselves." And the polls show that more than 75% of the world's Muslims have been saying that from day one and are still saying it. In the United States, 2/3, even though, I mean, it's probably far more than that. when I go around speaking about this, I get huge crowds, people in Morocco, Turkey, and they all say, "We know this. We know this. Go back to the United States and tell your people this. Why don't they know this?" So how do you think that this fact that Muslims know more in most cases about the details of what actually happened in 9/11 and have a interpretation that it was a false flag operation, this is completely suppressed. I got thrown out of the University of Wisconsin for researching it. How do they do that?
Wow, that's very sad that the University of Wisconsin did that, because the university is exactly the place where these questions should be asked and should be freely asked. You know, there are, as you know, there've been attempts to sideline scholarship, which questions certain historical acts in the Middle East. I'm thinking of what happened to a certain Columbia professor several years back during her tenure process over a book which detailed, in fact, the very renamings of places on the West Bank with more references to Hebrew traditions, Jewish traditions. And a lot of scholarship in the whole Daniel Pipes project, let's not forget that.
Right, campus
There's
watch
been,
or campus witch hunt.
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, this is just McCarthyism. And what's happening, unfortunately, is in the 1950s, more people were at least critical of this kind of real McCarthyism going on then. What's happening today, however, is the saint, this whole idea of the sacred, the dead, the innocent victim, has been used quite cleverly by the media to keep people shut up. In fact, it feeds into, I've been doing a whole series on terrorism with Counterpunch, because there's a whole jihad alert. I did an article a few months ago on France's and Britain's and the US's propaganda in the subways, and how we're supposed to now look out for people who don't wear, you know, Western dresses, literally a picture of a woman's dress from the 1950s, and who they have an X, the French have an X through the baguette. So if you don't eat French bread, you might be suspicious. Now, these are highly dangerous racialisms and reductive measures to target terrorists. You know, again, do you have fertilizer? Do you have a video camera? Do you have a mobile phone? So this kind of sacred has fed into a whole alert status. The whole alert system, in fact, that was set up after 9/11, was setting off school children. The red, yellow, green, blue alerts, you know, this set off children who, of course, were of a young age learning colors. They didn't quite understand this, and this actually freaked out quite a few school children in the New York City area. The fact that alerts were happening in terms of primary colors, you know.
Yeah, isn't that strange? And for years and years and years, you kept hearing the same announcement in the airports. The terror alert level has been raised to orange, and they kept saying raised to orange for about 10 years.
Right, and how many people actually understood that? And then the authorities know that it doesn't really matter. They could be saying, blah, the terror, you know, alert has been raised to sand. It doesn't matter. The fact is that this is how control functions. And that's why, you know, I mean, I did a piece a few weeks ago on Foucault's systems of power. This is extremely Foucauldian, the way that these terror systems have been able to amass not only people to maintain a certain ambiance of fear, but also for people to react against any perceived threat. In the UK, there was a kid a few years back who was accused of it was the actual charge was against the state treason for pronouncing on his Facebook page that all soldiers must die. Now, you know, that's a sentiment that he felt, and he wasn't particularly aiming at any one group's soldiers. However, he did
It's not
state,
a
you
bad
know, in
idea,
his in
actually.
well, he said, you know, basically, what are, I mean, that's what soldiers are supposed to do anyway. They're
That's what
supposed
they
to go and
do.
fight, and the risk
They kill
dying
and they
is
die.
there. And he says, you know, why is it that we're focusing only on British soldiers returning? He, you know, he was spared by a hair going to prison, received a lighter sentence that involved a out of prison, you know, formation. But the fact is that this kind of surveillance is going on all over. And we really need to be careful now, because we're seeing that with the rise also of the new atheist movement, we're seeing a huge use of that movement going strictly towards Islamophobia. I've seen it directly with Bill Maher and Richard Dawkins. And one can say, well, one can be skeptical about religion, but this isn't what's going on. The auspices of anti-religious belief is actually focusing specifically on one religion. And the way it's happening is quite pernicious. You know, the one example that Charlie Hebdo defenders would give is, oh, this is happening to all religions. We critique all religions. Well, that's not so. The fact is that there's been an augmented increase since 9/11 of critique against Islam. And the way the critiques happen are incredibly more vulgar and offensive, and they are actually set to spark off something. And this has been documented in my article. I linked to several reports that have actually studied and analyzed the statistics of Charlie Hebdo's publications in recent years, on top of two of their former, one current workers, employees, who have talked about this openly. But one can't talk about this openly, right? Because if you talk about this openly, then you're a terrorist sympathizer. So there's this whole cycle of inability to speak, because if you speak against the sacred, you're against the French state, you're against the whole concept of laïcité, secularism, that's very strong in France, but it's also hypocritically strong in France. You have a school system which still pays for religious education, let's not forget. And that religious education is not the local Muslim school, it's the Catholic school. And this is never discussed as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that there's been this strong reaction against religion in the West, and France probably had more of that and was the leader in this. With the French Revolution, which was partly against religion and the clergy. So there's been this strong laïcité in France, and it's demonized French Christianity for the most part. A lot of the French laic intellectuals and leaders actually seem to like Islam better than Christianity in many ways. Voltaire said a few things along those lines, although everything he said. And Napoleon actually, some say, actually converted to Islam when he was in Egypt or came very close to it. Many of these laic leaders seem to see Islam as being a sort of more rational version of Christianity, which I would agree that it actually is. But now it seems that they've turned totally against Islam. And, you know, you have to wonder why that is. Is it the power of the Jewish community? And let's face it, there is a religious war in the Middle East for the Holy Land of Palestine, and it's Zionist Jews versus Muslims. And since Zionist Jews have tremendous power in the West, some would argue that that community has, in a sense, hijacked the West and turned it against Islam. It's certainly a factor anyway. And then another factor, of course, would be the loss of the sacred in the West in general, the need to fill that vacuum with something. And it seems that it's being filled with a kind of a false worship of this idol of secularism, and that's fueled by Islamophobia.
Well, certainly. I mean, there is, at the same time, one could argue there still is there are incidents and there is such a thing as anti-Semitism that does exist. But the fact is since the State of Israel was established, and with great guilt to the West, I think there's been an overwhelming support for a state which has not been rationally thought out. It doesn't take much to read about the history and to see, you know, back to the white paper, what went on and how wrong it was at the beginning. Agreements made to both sides and the deceptions made to one. But what's even wronger, if we could say, is to look at a map. You go to B'Tselem, you know, an Israeli human rights organization, go to B'Tselem's website, open up any one of their West Bank maps. They do them every 2 years, and you can see the reduced land available for Palestinians to move about freely. And so this is a political war. I think it's also made to be a religious war, but it's very much about land against a people who are a mixture of Christians and Muslims primarily. And yes, by one state that is said to represent the Jewish people, but on the one hand, one could say it's religious from the Jewish state side, but certainly from the side that people suspect of being terrorists, it's actually not at all founded in religion that much at all. I mean, if you're talking about people arguing about Al-Aqsa and so forth, that's another discussion. But when we're talking about the entire landmass of what is today Gaza and the West Bank, not to mention all the lost land, the Golan Heights and so forth from past decades, you begin to see that this has been a slow usurpation of land and the disenfranchisement of these people to use the land, because as most people do not know, when Palestinians leave, they cannot return, you know. Right. So the right of return has actually created a huge problem there. And yes, all of this feeds, I mean, ideologically, people who want to rationalize their violence will pull straws from anywhere. So the, you know, obviously the murder of the murders at Charlie Hebdo were completely, I mean, horrible. And but the fact is this was not a Islamicist murder. These were two kids who were dispossessed culturally, socially, even intellectually. And no one wants to talk about that. That one group or the other wants to take credit for what happened is another affair. That's more of a political scenery. But what the actual groundwork of what happened back in January is one that relates much more to French culture, and people are not willing to look at it. You know, this was not France's 9/11. This was France's Ferguson, and that's a choice that they have to make to see, you know.
Okay, in what sense is it France's Ferguson?
Oh, well, this whole... Okay, go back to 2005 with the whole incidents of Clichy-sous-Bois, which actually ignited incidents all over the country of many immigrant communities, extremely poor, setting off against the police over what was a death of a young man. But this became what sparked a whole radical discussion of racism in France, a whole manifestation against the government, the police, and it ended up in everything, you know, cars burning, people fighting, curfews being laid out, and this lasted for several months.
Well, and that was Francis Ferguson, but Charlie Hebdo wasn't.
Yes, well, Charlie Hebdo is a continuation, I think, of some of the problems of race in that country that people do not want to discuss, or certainly of religious marginalization. And now these two kids, I mean, they were a product of foster homes. Their parents had died, actually. They were raised just on the outskirts of France and came back to France. And in order for them to have community where they weren't really embraced by any community, they were, you know, basically it was a bricolage of people, ideas. And this is what even the specialists are finding out when you start to look at, you know, the alleged terrorist. These are people who quite didn't fit in. You look at the same thing in Montreal with the killer at Dawson College. This happened back in, I want to say, 2007. I could be wrong. It could be around 2007, though. And that killer, again, was the son of immigrants who didn't quite fit in. We're seeing a lot of violence from these men who come from a Muslim, other, well, in the Dawson College case, I believe the young man was Sikh, but who don't quite fit into societies that are allegedly supposed to embrace difference and otherness. And then next thing you know, these tragedies are occurring. Now, obviously, most immigrants don't do that, but there is something to be said for what is happening with Islam and the way that youth are being acculturized in countries in the West, the US, France, whatever, and how they are led to approach themselves as human beings, much less the larger world that they're entering into. These men all share a similar age range. They all share a certain background of religious education, but secularism was injected at a certain point in their life due to immigration. And often, you know, the analysis goes as far as the missing father or the divorced parents. But what to do when you have then the representation of these cartoons that is used as a pretext for violence. Do cartoons really cause people to kill? Of course not. You know, the the Muslim world is incredibly tolerant towards what are insulting images of the Prophet and other ideas from Islam, right? Otherwise, we'd be seeing a lot more of this.
Right. Well,
The
my
idea.
impression is that actually there's so little of this kind of violence that it has to be manufactured. And frankly, in my book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, there are 21 contributors, and probably at least 15 have concluded that it was almost certainly an Operation Gladio style false flag. And it does seem to me, that's what Bernard Lewis said in his essay, his contribution to Netanyahu's book, Terrorism: How the West Can Win. That's the book that collects the pieces that came out of the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism, or JCIT, which was where the War on Terror was created. They drafted the concept of a war on terror to unite the West at that conference. And so Netanyahu's book, Terrorism: How the West Can Win, which is quite a title, basically tells us that that's the program. The way the West is going to win is through terrorism. Lewis, the number one advisor to MI6, the man who flew over to see Bush right after 9/11, his first advisor to come visit after 9/11, Lewis writes an essay that on the surface appears rather innocuous, saying that, there's no real link between Islam and terrorism. But beneath the surface, the implication is because he's of course a scholar of the Ismaili assassins. He did his dissertation on the assassins. The implication that he's giving us, which fits right into that Netanyahu's book, is that because there isn't enough terrorism in the Islamic world, and the way the West can win is by manufacturing a quote unquote Islamic terror threat, then the West is going to have to turn Operation Gladio, which, as you probably know, was the program that committed almost all of the really big terrorist atrocities in Europe during the Cold War. We were told that it was leftist terrorism. Virtually all of it was conducted by the Pentagon through NATO. Okay, so essentially, what these guys were calling for was a turning Operation Gladio into a system of manufacturing pseudo-Islamic terrorism. And I'm 100% certain that's what happened on 9/11, and I'm 98% certain that's what happened in Paris, as are a great many people, including most of the contributors to my book. So I find that it's actually, and since this is what most Muslims think, I find the way that the sort of standard academic discourse avoids this is very strange. I mean, everybody admits that it's essentially a historical fact attested to by the European Parliament that Operation Gladio manufactured the Bologna train bombing, the Brabant shootings. All of the big leftist terror incidents during the Cold War were committed by the United States Pentagon commanding NATO. And nobody's ever been
Well,
prosecuted for that.
certainly you have two readings for every act. I mean, first, there's the act on the ground. I mean, these kids, were they part of a larger conspiracy? I
Well,
mean,
they
they
were
were
clearly
left.
intelligence informants, and the authorities have lied about that. They were busted for child pornography, and that was made to go away. That when that happens, that means you've been recruited as an intelligence informant.
Okay. Well, this is, I did not know about the child pornography edge of this. What I do know is that a lot of these young kids who are, committing mass murder are often spun because they're dead. They can't talk. So everything is spun politically. It was very easy for two different groups came up and claimed the bombing at Charlie Hebdo, right?
Yeah,
It
Al-Qaeda
was
in the what in
completely.
Yemen was one of them, supposedly.
Yes. And then this comes about as this was a actual fracturing between Al Qaeda and AXIS.
And
I'm
didn't
sorry,
Islamic
Al
some
Qaeda.
Islamic State per, supposed
It
person
was
claim it?
Islamic. Yes.
Yeah,
I
but
mean,
see, this all
initially
this
there were
always
two.
comes out through Rita Katz. I mean, how do we know who's really claiming these things? Because it's 90% of the time we're getting it through Rita Katz at Site International. Why would
Well,
real
how
Islam, what
can.
Muslim jihadis send their pictures to Rita Katz, a Mossad
Right.
person? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Well, the whole thing becomes very almost Hollywood like comedy. How do you. It all seems too scripted when you start to read the meta narrative. So you have the local story of what these two kids were doing and what they set up to do. They were clearly two thugs who had serious anger issues. Did they use Islam as a pretext? Did they use, anger towards, for instance, society as a pretext? We know that they did have both, in fact. But the way that these narratives are then politicized within the media and then governments, then this is another reason to, oh, let's keep the terror alert high. Let's keep checking out these kinds of people. And this is used as a way of screening, of targeting, right? And not just Muslims. We know for a fact that all of these terrorist measures have been used on other sorts of non-terrorist activities, right? This is about information control. I mean, this is all tied up with the NSA as well and what's been going on that side of things. And you look to, you're talking about terrorism in Europe during the Cold War. I mean, look at the Brigata Rossa. That was never framed as a Christian terrorist organization, right? So we have a very specific target of Islam, and the reason being that these states, it's one day this, one day that. I mean, who's it going to be tomorrow? There's certain political and economic advantages to having troops on the ground in these places and setting up, you know. I mean, the irony is you go into a country like Iraq and then you have Halliburton and Bechtel receive huge contracts to clean up, you know. And this has been going on. Many of these companies were involved in trying to privatize gas, water, electricity in Bolivia. It was in the early 2000s that they were kicked out of Bolivia as well, you know. So there's a larger political spectrum of how transnational corporations have their hand in this. When I was doing work in Haiti after the earthquake there, I saw firsthand how in these cluster meetings, strangely, there'll be CEOs of companies in a cluster meeting offering for free all these products, but what they really want is the contract that they have in their other hand to be signed, right? So there's a whole process.
Sounds like disaster, you know, capitalism that Naomi Klein talks about.
It is. Well, disaster relief, all of the humanitarian efforts going on are mostly fraudulent, I hate to say. No one talks on the news. They show, you know, Nepal in the news, and one can only wonder if they're Nepalese of dark skin, because it seems they're investigating only white people who are climbing a mountain at some point, and their friends and family back home. But no one asking the real questions. How much are these aid workers making? So there's a larger question there, too, of really the kind of manipulation going on behind the camera. And we're being told all sorts of stories. It's really hard for the average person watching the news or reading an online story to understand what's going on, because unless they dig and read beyond CNN and Fox and the BBC as well, I mean, these are horrible media sources that will tell you silly stories and you'll feel good about yourself, you know?
And isn't the Academy the place where we're supposed to be deconstructing these false narratives manufactured by the media? That's what I always thought. And I think the neoconservatives came along just at the time that there was this kind of, you know, marriage between big money capitalism and the imperial state, you know, going for broke, seeing that the West is going down the tubes at some point, and so they'd better go for broke and try and conquer the planet while they still have a shot at it. And the neoconservatives, who are found in all of the poli-sci departments and many history departments and various other departments in the universities, actually don't believe in seeking for the truth and speaking it in public. They think that the truth is so dangerous that it must be reserved to an elite that can handle it. And therefore, you know, they think that Socrates deserved to be killed because he spoke the truth in the marketplace. And that's the highest crime.
Yeah.
So with those people in the academy, it becomes problematic for us to do our jobs, which is, I thought, to critique the myths and the irrational elements of the culture and, you know, cut through the lies. Have you ever had any kind of pushback yourself in terms of people in the academy, whether administrations or colleagues, being uncomfortable with anything you were teaching?
Indirectly once, yes. I was teaching a course on Islamophilia, Islamophobia, going from the Orientalist project of loving Islam to today. And yes, I did at one place where I taught. It wasn't overt. And that's the thing, is a lot of these universities are aware that there is, you know, academic freedom that needs to be respected. However, this what we're seeing. Look at academia. It's really. I don't know how to put it politely, but it's a cesspool today. We have, and I'm not talking about just the U.S. I'm very much thinking of the U.K., where I've been teaching for some time, where the education is now £9,000 a year. That's approximately $14,000-$15,000 U.S., which is peanuts compared to many U.S. institutions. But what's going on is a pressure to dumb down the teaching, to not have students read and write. And I experienced this, I've experienced this almost constantly for the past 10 years. And that's why a lot of academics leave academia. And some of the best people in academia, the smartest, the most published, are not getting jobs in academia today. So is it surprising that these discussions aren't happening? Because you're having the managementization of academia occur, and it's been going on since the late 90s fiercely for the last 10 years. They're putting people with new PhDs in positions of power, chair people, head of departments, even deans. There are people who have got PhDs for 2 years who are deans. These people know nothing about academia, and they're not scholars. So academia has consciously been put in the hands. And I'm not speaking about all universities. Thank goodness there are exceptions. And I think the U.S. offers more exceptions than the U.K. But the academic scene is being put in these universities in the hands of people who are there to drive the management-oriented system. Just recently, there's been a lot of protest against PowerPoint. I'll give you an example of that. And PowerPoint's this way of teaching, right? Well, I've never used PowerPoint a day in my life, nor will I. I mean, it's become a method of students to pick up their cameras, their phones, click, and that's how they take notes. The professor just puts up a screen of 4 bullet points, click. And that's learning? No. So we've actually gone backwards in terms of education, and this is affecting universities outside the West as well, where learning is becoming bullet points, dumbed down. And it's about getting as many students crammed into the classroom. That's why PowerPoint's great. You can show it to a huge theater of people, even if they can't hear you. And no one's thinking about quality of education. The slashing of humanities programs. Campus Watch was part of larger project, I believe, of cutting away any discussion, not just of Israel, let's say, or who teaches Orientalism, goodness knows. It was a larger project of getting rid of humanities. Today, people are being taught to teach students just a very limited amount of information to get a job, right? So universities are now turned into employment centers. It's very sad. And I respect the universities that do not abide by these policies, but more and more universities are going this way, including the abuse of professors, adjunct faculty in the UK. The adjunct faculty are called, and it sounds really nice, visiting professors. You couldn't pay a quarter of a month's rent on what you're paid as a visiting professor.
Mm. Yeah, isn't that ironic? You know, when I was being raked over the coals in the media after I was witch hunted out of the University of Wisconsin, I was being called a lecturer, which I suppose, in the U.S., lecturer is the general title for people who are not on tenure track. Right. But then after that, I got a job at Kaplan University, which is this really awful, dumbed down, privatized thing run by the Washington Post. That's kind of another story. But there I was called a visiting professor. And it was actually, if anything, I would say 3 rungs below the lecturer position I had at the University of Wisconsin in terms of mm-hmm. pay and prestige, but they were calling it a professorship. And there everything came with prepackaged PowerPoints. And that's everybody pretty much had to give the same MIC PowerPoint. It was quite amazing. I mean, there was a good side to it, which was there were tiny little classes and it was possible to actually try to teach writing the way it should be taught. And you need to have tiny classes to do that. Spend lots of time with each student's writing and deal with their individual problems. But my goodness, it seems that
at least they're writing there. You know, many universities Students aren't, there's, the US has done something very good by having writing centers in most every university that I've taught in, everyone. And you go to the UK and abroad, that's not the case. They want students to ka-ching out, you know, take the money, get a degree, and there'll be universities around the world that are giving students degrees who can barely write in English. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think that's actually the single most useful thing that can be done at universities is helping people ratchet up their writing to the point that they can write like college graduates. And that's why I actually got a certificate in composition, even though I'm more interested in teaching literature and Arabic and Islamic studies and things like that. Composition is the most useful thing that you could possibly teach to undergraduates.
It
But
goes back to critical thinking. If you teach people how to write, I mean, they have to think through their processes of what they're writing about, what they've read, that they're basing their writing on, etc. And it's all related because nowadays, now, you know, Campus Watch is winning the war in that sense because now you don't have to read anymore. Just, you know, the people are actually teaching from textbooks, believe it or not. So they're not actually reading anything directly written by someone, they're reading about someone who says something about someone. And that's what's happening today. It's quite sad. And I think, well, it explains the exodus of some really good people from academia who've gone to journalism and think tanks and other venues, you know. But in terms of understanding how, you know, the this all fits into how people read the global war and terror, you know. People aren't reading. See, this is what happens. We've got this great information highway, but no one's using the information highway. People are going to Reddit and Tumblr for their news, which is a sad state of affairs, but it is so. And
Right.
it's also driven up what I call, you know, internet rage, the internet version of road rage, where people no longer can discuss logically issues. Everyone's accused of, you know, of trying to kill the other person by their thoughts, right? And this is going on currently.
We've
Yeah,
I've
you
seen
can't
some
actually.
I've seen some unfortunate examples of that recently where I work at Veterans Today, one of the places I work, where people are accusing each other of zapping each other with space beams and things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the difference of opinion doesn't mean you're threatening the other person's existence.
Yeah,
And
no kidding.
this has contributed to the fallout of discussion. So people, you know, in this great era of all this possibility we have at our fingertips to learn and read millions of ideas, literally, people want to keep it dumbed down to their opinion. So nothing is really about information anymore. It's about what they think. It goes back to Stephen Colbert's truthiness. He was making a joke about George Bush when he said that George Bush thinks with his gut. But again, just like George Bush's "you're with us" or "you're against," "you're with the terrorists," the fact is tr Colbert's truthiness speaks to what is actually going on. People are not thinking; people are feeling. And so, what's happened in the 21st century is we're seeing a society of people who don't care about facts. Science? Oh, no science. If I feel this, I am this. And that is a problem because there is such a thing as reality. Yeah. And we're in this age of everything being dismissed. It's interesting. I just saw an interesting interview with Don McLean on BBC, and he was talking about this kind of social construction as well, where nothing is as it seems, and where he posits there's an inverse of the left and the right today, that the left has become radicalized in such a way that you can no longer speak freely. And I have to agree with him. A lot of people who, again, they think they're leftists, I'd call them more neoliberals, actually shut down discussion completely. And there is no way to interact because you're immediately accused of being a murderer, a terrorist sympathizer, what have you. And the discussion goes way beyond just Middle Eastern politics. Follow what's happening with the feminists. Yeah, oh, they're accused of murder when they start to debate gender and critique gender, right? So I find it very interesting that you can no longer discuss ideas without being called a bigot, or any other number of epithets to shut you down, including having your livelihood threatened. Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. You know, I just saw a talk, a very brilliant talk by Gilad Atzmon, the ex-Israeli defector, who's one of the best jazz saxophonists in the world. Yeah, he just came out with another book, just very, very acerbically criticizing not only Zionism, but also the anti-Zionism. And of course, he's taken all kinds of abuse. But his main target is the left, or what passes for the left, which he argues has been completely co-opted. It's an interesting perspective. So, and the people who come out to see him are often, pro-Palestine leftists, exactly the very people that he is critiquing. Very, very interesting stuff. But his larger point is that the left has gone downhill with identity politics. And I've seen other very thoughtful people make this argument as well. And I would tend to agree with it up to a point. They argue that, when the left shifted from social justice in the sense of basically taking care of people economically to vaunting these various identities, whether it's female identity with feminism or African American identity or Jewish identity, gay studies, all this sort of thing, that it essentially was a divide and conquer strategy. Whether it was intentional or not, who knows, but it essentially divided and conquered the very people who should be uniting against the 1% or the 0.001%. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, well, I'm very critical of identity politics, and I'm a post-structuralist slash postmodernist. I think this theory has its uses, but the theories coming out of the late 80s and 90s have been largely abused, and again, going back to cultural illiteracy, completely misread. So we're seeing a real debate happening between, well, I referred to the feminists earlier, but a historical materialist feminism, let's call it, that is actually, dealing with reality on the ground of these are what female girls experience. Boko Haram girls are female, and they can't just say that they're male to get out of being kidnapped, right? And meanwhile, they're debating trans activists who have identities based on feeling. Again, going back to Colbert's, if you feel it, it must be true. It's who's to tell me Vietnam didn't happen yesterday, right? If I feel it did, then it's true. And there's this synapse between material, historical reality, and collective consciousness. And then what Gail Dines, a feminist, she states, I saw an interview of hers recently, or a talk of hers recently, where she says that feminism has changed so much that today's feminism is more, I've got what I want, now fuck you, So we've become a very neoliberal society, everyone out for themselves, no one really looking out for anyone else. And identity politics feeds perfectly into this because you have a society where people are not really interested in looking at the social problems at all. They're looking at how they can get something out of the system to help them, and to help them advance their own narrative.
Right.
And all materiality gets elided, and all that is left is the abstract self reimagined person as a collection of traits. So everything is made so abstract that when you start to follow a lot of the discourses around identity politics, they actually don't make sense. You're saying all these things are true, but then you've just backtracked on a series of other facets you've just said were not true. And it's very hard to follow neoliberal thought because it repackages reactionary ideas to make them hip and palatable to liberals. The idea that we can all get behind like there was a critique made about Bruce Jenner being a woman and an actress from Hollywood. I actually don't play Hollywood at all, but she's apparently a British actress who said, but he's a man. He has all the privilege of a man. The minute she said this, she was accused of being a transphobe. I was shocked because she was speaking a truth. He would never have won one gold medal. If he were a woman athlete in 1976, he would have never made it to Montreal in all likelihood. Women athletes, let's not even talk about the funding differences, right? But she stated something obvious and then was forced to recant her thoughts, right? So this is very Orwellian. This is very scary, where what she was saying was not hateful. She was stating a social fact about male athletes, right? And this is what's going on, that, you know, now she's transphobic.
You know, this, yeah,
So.
this, and this whole, that whole kind of discussion strikes me as very, very strange. And I think it would strike most people throughout most of history as very strange. You know, in the post-Axial Age era, the two main kinds of identity were religious and tribal. You know, who are you? Well, your family relationships or ascribed family relationships, that's your tribe, and your sacred rights, it's your religion. And that's pretty much how it's been for most of the world up until very recently. And now we have people defining themselves according to their gender or their sexual preference. Their whole identity is based on what kind of sex they want or what kind of object of sex they want. I mean, how weird. It seems like the culture, frankly, my take is that we're in the last throes of extreme decadence. Am I being a sexist transphobe when I say that?
Well, you know, the fact is today you can't say anything unless it beats to, you know, goes to a certain drum rhythm that will not have you called something. And I think this is where it's interesting to look at the division even in the gay community. Those who are very critical of transgenderism, because they're like, that's everything I had to fight against as a young gay kid growing up in Kansas. I was told that if I played with dolls, I must be a girl. Now I'm being told I am a girl, you know? And so there's a really good backlash happening against some of what is very regressive gender normativity. But ironically, the transgender crowd, the transgender narrative, let's say, dictates itself as being anti-binary and being anti-gender normative. But it's everything but anti-gender normative. That's the problem. So what's happening today, I mean, this is very, Jean Baudrillard talks about the simulacra. And this is a space of simulacra for me, where language is saying one thing and actions are actually doing the other, right? And people tend to pay attention to actions. But I'm thinking in this era, people are paying more attention to words. And that's because we're disembodied by the internet. Much of this quote unquote activism is happening online. None of this would be happening in real person, in actual life, face to face, because there'd be another discussion happening, right? But when you're watching an internet discussion with one person saying, but my penis is female, you're sort of left thinking, this is not
I
a
don't think I've
William
had that
Gibson
discussion,
novel.
but
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is when women and even men, there's a lot of male feminists online arguing about this as well, and they're saying, but that's not reality. You know, the reality is women are raped, and they talk about the actual reality of women's rights. And the fact is, you know, like one of these feminists recently said, these Boko Haram girls can't get out of their predicament by identifying as male, can they? So the discussion is strangely, it's just elliptical. It goes back to, you know, you think you're in a science fiction novel when you read it, but in real life, when you sit down and talk to people, yeah, a lot of people are sort of offended by some of the identity politics going on. What's interesting, though, in the case.
Isn't this all kind of society of the spectacle? Like this Boko Haram is sort of a spectacle of the worst fears and fantasies of horrible, you know, abusive women. And of course, in reality, most Muslim feminists basically want to empower themselves through Islam, which forces men to support them. If you're liberated from the Islamic system as a woman, suddenly you don't have that male support. And of course, anthropologically, that's what marriage is it's a way of channeling testosterone and libido of young men into enforcing them to, in exchange for sex, take care of somebody, take care of a woman, take care of kids. I mean, and this is
Well,
how it's been forever. And it seems like this has been completely lost in this brave new world of bizarre, you know, gender fantasies these days.
I think it's fine that people want to have other realities or not be married, or, you know, Queen Latifah. I was just reading an interview with her because she's just made this Bessie Smith biopic, and for years she's been suspected of being a lesbian, and she's like, I won't talk about my private life in public. That's it. And
Hey,
I think
that's
that's
great.
really
You know what?
true.
Why are we always
Yeah.
talking about this stuff anyway? It's you know that's what I like about Iran. Every time I go to Iran, so comfortable because I'm living in a society that's sort of a lot more like the one I grew up in the early 60s America, where, sexuality is private. It's not for the public sphere. You don't bring sexuality into the public sphere. You don't talk about trans this and bi that and queer this. You don't talk about sex acts. You don't
Well,
talk about any sexuality. You keep it for the
the
private sphere.
counter-argument that we live in a heterosexist culture where heterosexuality is everywhere, and to be fair, it is, because the minute we start talking
Not in
about
Iran.
marriage, once marriage is male and female, that becomes a dominant discourse. And I have no problems with people wanting to, even if I'm not pro-marriage, let's say if gay marriage or whatever people want to do is fine. I think there's more of a problem that the discourse of discussing the problems between what's going on and what people think and what people are feeling, there's been a larger monolith created in the media, let's say, in neoliberal media, of you can't speak back to this problem. So there's this whole shut up and march to this beat again, and there's no real deconstruction of ideas. There's no real discussion happening, and that's where I have a problem. I think that there should be a lot of healthy debate, and that we should be able to discuss these issues, even if people li don't like them. Just like the Charlie Hebdo article I wrote, I wasn't advocating for censorship, but I was advocating that people are able to completely discuss the problems that are inherent within the representations and even the market problems about what really went on, and no one's doing that. The same thing with issues of gender today. We're not really able to discuss gender because now laws are being made to codify any thought that goes counter to this new thought as hate speech. And I do disagree with that because that will actually end up very badly. You can't codify hate speech against people, that's simply a different approach to the same ideas of gender,
Indeed, if I start saying I like Iran's gender norms, I'm sure that the thought police will come after me pretty fast. And if it's actually encoded into law, geez, I might have to flee the country. Well, I think we're about at the end of the hour, Julian Vigo. It's been very interesting, and I hope to have you back to continue this kind of discussion. I think it's great to hear somebody. You're looking at a lot of the issues that people that I studied literature with were looking at, and you're thinking more freely about them than most. So I really appreciate that, and I appreciate your great article on Charlie Hebdo, and look forward to another conversation down the line.
Thank you very much. Look forward.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
bye-bye.